Meeting of Crime Victims Criminal Records Division will come to order. First order of business, we will do introductions. So why don't we start out, after my microphone is fixed, why don't we start out at this end of the table and go around and just introduce yourself and your role.
My name is Kate Weeks. I'm with DFL Caucus Research.
Dave Olin, representing District 1A, further northwest corner.
Deborah Hillstrom, I represent all of the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park.
Harlan Bingham, I represent 57A, which is half of Cottage Grove, most of South St. Paul, Central Park, Newport, and Great Falls Island County.
Becky Perriott, South Research.
I'm Patrick Baldwin. I'm the committee administrator.
I'm John Lesh, the chair, District 66A, North End, East Side, Como Park, neighborhoods of St. Paul.
Erin Hubert, committee legislative assistant.
I'm Matt Gagnon, House Research. And I should also point out that depending on the topic this committee is taking on, you may also see Jeff Diebel from our office here. He's home this morning with his brand new two twin sons.
Ron Shemansky, District 18A, McLeod and Meeker County, vice chair of this committee and GOP lead.
Dennis Verdon, Republican Research.
We'll wait till a couple more of them get situated here. I see Corey and Jennifer. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves, where you're from, and that's it.
Corey Kapp, I represent 26A, Owatonna and Wasika are the main cities within that district, and I am a freshman here, so I look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair.
I look forward to the hazings. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jennifer Loon from 42B, Eden Prairie.
Thank you. Is that everyone? We do have some familiar faces in the audience as well, some of whom are on the bill today to talk about what they're going to be proposing for legislative ideas this session, and some who aren't, and so I may ask them to introduce themselves if we have time today. This committee is currently scheduled for 8:30 on Friday mornings. That potentially could change, so just to let you all know, depending on what could happen here, but the meeting time may change. I will tell you that the current structure of this division has changed because last year it was set up as two separate subcommittees, and it was difficult to manage how that would work. And so we created it as a separate independent division that would share responsibilities on these areas of criminal public safety policy with Chair Hillstrom. And Chair Hillstrom and I have had conversations on what bills would go between us, and I think there will be decent cooperation there. That said, the purview of this committee will be, as is stated, crime victims, areas that you know that we've dealt with before in the subcommittee, including domestic violence, the crime victims' rights statute, which is delineated in a chapter of Minnesota statutes, also criminal records, which is anything from CrimNet, for those of you who are familiar with CrimNet, and also with expungements or collateral sanctions, which are an ever-increasing area of concern for the state of Minnesota, considering the amount of information that is out there. I will also say it was my intent to meet with each of you members prior to today, but the first half of the week, this week, I was in trial, and it crimped my style a little bit to be here, so my apologies, and we will get an opportunity here to meet hopefully in the next week so I can get some of your ideas also on the direction you think we should go.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bingham.
Are you going to tell us what the verdict was?
Oh, well, I won.
Oh, good.
I always win.
Good.
Not always, but I did this time, so. Thank you. No, it was a prostitution case which was put together by the ABLE St. Paul Vice Unit and the St. Paul Police Department, and I won't tell you what hotel they're using for stings these days, because they don't like it when I say that. Why don't we start off with, if we can, the Crime Victim Services Overview, which is Section 4 of the agenda, and we can have Jerry Boisberg come up here with the Department of Public Safety, Office of Justice Programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. I'm grateful for this opportunity to do a very brief and very low-tech overview of crime victim services and the Office of Justice Program. I know you got up this morning, you were hoping you'd get more paper, and that's what you got from me. Those blue folders contain just a few items. I tried to be discreet on how much I put in. If you open it up on the right side, what you have is the overview of the Office of Justice Programs and all of its programs, including contact information of myself and a number of other crime victims lead staff that are here with me today. Behind that is a list of all the crime victim grant programs, the amount of funding they receive, what judicial district they're in, and what kind of services they provide. On the left-hand side are three reports. Two of them are hot off the presses, one not even off the press, really. The reparations report for this year, the Crime Victim Justice Unit report, and I put in a copy of the human trafficking report, which comes out of our office, out of our statistical analysis center, because I'm sure this topic will be coming up in the future. I promised Patrick I could do this in under 5 minutes, so I will do my best to do so. Our Crime Victim Services comprised of 24 staff who provide assistance to Minnesota crime victims in four distinct program areas: Crime Victim Reparations, the Crime Victim Justice Unit, Grants for Local Programs, and the Training and Communications Team. Reparations, in concert with the Reparations Board, provides victims and families direct compensation for losses as a result of a violent crime. Expenses include medical costs, mental health care, funeral and burial costs, lost wages, loss of support. In fiscal year 08, the unit received over 1,800 claims and provided almost $3 million in compensation to victims. This program is supported by a general fund appropriation, Federal Victims of Crime Act funds, VOCA funds, inmate wages and restitution, and civil awards paid to victims. The program also trains criminal justice professionals and service providers around the state about the reparations program. The Crime Victim Justice Unit provides information and referral and assistance in navigating the criminal justice system to the public. They also develop important resources for professionals, for example, the Minnesota Crime Victim Rights Reference Guide. Most importantly, they investigate statutory crime victim rights violations and victim mistreatment. In fiscal year 7 and 8, the CVJU opened 97 formal cases and had contacts from over 3,000 criminal justice professionals, victims, and the public. The grants unit last year provided or administered almost $33 million in grant funds to over 150 crime victim service providers who provide direct services and advocacy to victims in the general crime area, child abuse, domestic violence, and sexual assault. The general crime programs services are offered in 60 counties, and last year they served over 35,000 primary and secondary victims. The abused children programs provide services in 37 counties and served over 6,900 children last year. Domestic violence programs provide services in 82 counties and last year provided services to over 60,000 victims. 10,000 of those victims approximately received emergency shelter services. The sexual assault program services were provided in 74 counties and they served over 12,000 primary and secondary victims of sexual assault. We have an emergency grant program, which we provide the grants range from $1,000 to $5,000 for emergency needs of crime victims. This can cover moving expenses, temporary shelter, travel to court proceedings. And in fiscal year 08 and 09, we had a one-time appropriation to provide relief to victims of auto theft. And we provided funds to 291 victims of auto theft to pay their impound costs. Last but not least is the Training and Communications Division, who provide training on crime victim issues across the state. Last year they provided training to over 200 people, put on our annual conference, which actually has attendance of over between 400 and 500 each year. And we are now conducting an annual Victim Assistance Academy, which is an intensive 40-hour crime victim training program, and we are graduating 40 to 50 students each year. They also manage the VINE system, which provides phone or online notification to victims and others on the custody status of offenders. We're operating in 68 counties now with 7 on board. We also have one position that we support in the Department of Corrections, which is the Community Notification and Victim Liaison to DOC. They provide a victim perspective at all the end of confinement review hearings, as well as provide post-conviction support to family members of life review hearings.
I'm going to mention our Statistical Analysis Center, which is a mighty crowd of two. They provide criminal justice information and research, and I mention them because they have been providing support to the Human Trafficking Task Force and have created the human trafficking report that is in your file, and I'm sure you'll be hearing more about human trafficking as the session goes on. They're also working with the United Way to gather and analyze a crime victim survey of Minnesota residents, as well as a domestic violence shelter survey as well, and those studies should be available within the next 30 days or so. I told Patrick less than five. I hope I did so. I invite you to look at our website. We have a variety of publications that may be helpful to you. Please feel free to call us at any time, any questions you might have, and we'd be happy to answer any that you have right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Woodward. And would you please state your name and title for the record, please?
You bet. Jerry Boisvert. I'm the Director of the Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Public Safety.
And I think I said your name wrong twice now and started last year, so I'm sorry about that again.
There's no problem. I've been called many, many terrible things.
Me
that
too.
Was not so bad.
Absolutely. Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Boisvert? I have a couple initially. Ms. Boisvert, have you seen any increasing needs on any of those services that you've seen from any particular parts of the state, whether it be rural, suburban, urban, or any geographical region as well, that has been increasing over the course, say, the past 10 years?
We have some very specific and detailed statistics that we'll be putting on our website shortly, but what we are anecdotally and gathering figures on right now is the increased need for shelter in the metro area. And we'll provide the data as soon as we have it aggregated for you.
Okay. Thank you. And can you please describe also, there are some there's some freshmen on this committee and also folks that maybe don't have previous experience in a criminal justice area. When you say human trafficking, what do you mean by that?
That's a question. The definition is in your report. It is mostly defined as the trade of human beings for labor or for sex trade, whether it's international or domestic.
Yeah. Thank you. If there aren't any other additional questions, I appreciate that, Ms. Woodward. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And next, if we can have Donna Dunn. Okay. So, I'm sorry, it's going to be Carolyn Palmer. Okay, and Leah Sweet, please. Yes.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And we thank you very much for allowing us to be part of your agenda this morning.
Thank you.
MnCASA was founded in 1978 and currently provides technical assistance and support to over 70 sexual assault advocacy programs statewide. We collaborate with advocates, county attorneys, law enforcement, medical staff, social services, legal services, and many others to learn from one another and to work effectively together to change systems and policies to better meet the needs of sexual assault survivors. MnCASA is recognized as a resource, and we hope that you will look to us for help to find any answers that you might have about sexual violence in Minnesota. This morning, I will provide a brief overview about MnCASA's legislative action agenda. MnCASA developed this agenda in collaboration with the Public Policy Committee. As you will see on the teal copy provided to you, our agenda is divided into three key goals. The first goal is preventing sexual violence. We're committed to increasing primary prevention of sexual violence through a number of different initiatives, as listed, and we will be working closely with the Health Policy and Finance Committees on meeting these objectives. I will note for purposes of this committee's charge that MnCASA believes sexual violence prevention informs all of the work that we do, and really most specifically in the area of criminal justice response to sexual violence. At this point, I would really like to extend an invitation to you to attend our legislative kickoff, which is next week, Wednesday the 21st. It's going to be starting at 11:30 for lunch and 12 o'clock with a presentation by a noted sexual violence prevention expert named Cordelia Anderson. The information is provided to you in your packet on the green sheet. The second goal of our agenda is to provide support and care for victims and survivors. We do this through maintaining funding for sexual assault victim service grants. We want to make sure that face-to-face services for sexual assault victims are available. This includes 24-hour crisis intervention that's free and confidential, help accessing emergency and support services, short and long-term emotional support, and much more. Victim services are already at risk for losing funds because only half of the dollars approved in 2007 have been added to the base. We provided details to the House Public Safety Finance Committee earlier this week and will continue to work with its members to protect this funding. I have a fact sheet with additional information about the sexual assault grant program, and I can provide it to the committee if requested. Our third goal is to create a criminal justice system that helps us stop sexual violence. This portion of the agenda was developed with our Access to Justice Subcommittee, a group of prosecutors from several counties, and a representative from the Attorney General's office. Our criminal justice agenda is supported by the Minnesota County Attorney Association. I will preface this portion of my testimony by stating that Minkasa is very aware of the budget issues facing the state and recognizes that you'll have to make some extremely difficult decisions this year. We understand that changes to the criminal statutes may result in fiscal impact. Still, we believe financial barriers should not prevent us from talking about what the state can do to improve the laws governing criminal sexual conduct. In fact, we want to look at ways to reduce costs for the judicial system and corrections. And to that end, we really want to work in close collaboration with this committee to find realistic solutions and to ensure the accuracy of any fiscal notes. We have two objectives within our criminal justice agenda. The first is to increase the penalty for fifth-degree convictions. This statute covers non-consensual sexual conduct, contact, and engaging in masturbation or lewd exhibition of the genitals in the presence of a minor under age 16. This change supports our prevention goals by ensuring that a person with any prior felony or gross misdemeanor sex assault conviction who then commits any version of fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct has that offense enhanced to a felony level. The current law only enhances certain prior convictions involving minors. This change that we are proposing would also trigger registration and lengthier probation periods. The prosecutors we've worked with tell us that the law as it currently stands serves as a loophole in the system that allows certain offenders to continually act without any significant consequence because there is no registration, and the jail time that's provided is really not long enough. We're looking forward to working with this committee on further developing this proposal. Our second objective is to advance an omnibus technical review bill with small but important technical revisions to the criminal sexual conduct statutes. This is a new process for the legislature and this committee, and we'd like to work with you to establish a streamlined approach to improving the existing statutes and expanding access to justice for victims. These are changes requested by prosecutors or noted in appellate court decisions. Our intent is not to establish new crimes or to recodify the statutes. We would like this bill to become part of an annual or biannual process coordinated with this committee. The bill that we're proposing this year has four components, all of which are noted on the blue sheet provided in your packet. The first is to extend the statute of limitations to the longer of 9 years after the offense or 3 years after reporting to law enforcement for individuals victimized as minors. The inconsistency in the statute was noted in a 2008 Court of Appeals decision, and that decision is State versus Krikorian, and I can certainly provide a copy of that to this committee if you request it. The second point is that we'd like to change the definition of sexual contact to include contact by semen or sperm to the victim's body or clothing. Currently, the statute defines contact to be by or with another's intimate body parts without consent or when consent is not a defense. The third is to equalize the charge available for an accomplice in the actor where force is used as part of first-degree sexual conduct. And the last piece is to reinstate language inadvertently repealed when the sentencing guidelines were changed a few years ago, and that is namely a 36-month mandatory presumptive sentencing for offenders for first through fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct and criminal predatory sexual conduct if the offender has been convicted of similar conduct within the past 15 years. Before I close, I again would like to extend two invitations to you. The first, again, is to attend our legislative kickoff event next Wednesday, and also to attend the Action Day to End Violence Against Women in the Capitol Rotunda on February 11th. Thank you once again for your time and attention. We definitely look forward to working with you throughout the year, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have right now.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Are there any questions for Ms. Palmer? Of course, I have another question, Ms. Palmer. There are multiple proposals for dealing with individuals who continue to have what they call collateral sanctions issues related to reporting or registration or criminal convictions on their record. What is you or your organization's perspective on this? I know that's a broad question, but you get the gist of what I'm talking about.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
So you're talking, for example, about reentry issues or inability to get a job or housing or things like that?
Yes.
Okay. That's certainly an issue that we do recognize that is something that people are facing. And that is something that we can certainly talk about further and provide more information to you on. We are certainly keeping track of work that organizations like the Council on Crime and Justice are doing and looking on collateral consequences issues. I think that's a tough question because we're balancing public safety, and we want to make sure that the victims and survivors we work with and the community is safe. So at this point, I would say that we recognize that that's a key issue, and we'd certainly be happy to talk with the committee further about that.
Thank you. And also, Ms. Palmer, one other question. These proposals for consideration in 2009, I'm assuming there are probably some examples or anecdotes of why you're pushing them, and at some point, I'm willing to bet that we're probably going to want to see what those are. The reason I bring that up is much of the policy around here is derived from certain instances that have happened, especially with high-profile sex crimes with respect to Katie Poirier or Drew Shadeen. That's your major legislative initiatives in the years following those crimes. So it's sometimes good to have those stories to clarify what happened and what could happen.
Mr. Chair, yes, we do have, amongst our group of prosecutors, they have cases that relate to the different areas that we're talking about, certainly with regard to the change in the fifth degree statute, but I think within all of these, they've all had an experience with it. And when we return to this committee, we will be bringing them with us to give you more details about those cases.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Palmer. Finally, Ms. Sweet.
Good morning. My name is Leah Sweet, and I'm pleased to be here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, formerly the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition, and Executive Director is the fancy word for the only part-time paid staff person. I like to say we're like my son. We're small, but we're mighty. We have about 60 members or so, give or take. The vast majority of our members are crime victim advocates who work in general crime, which is 39 different crime areas. We're not going to go over all of them. But the way that I explain to people is our advocates work with work on crime issues for which there is a clear victim or a victim. It includes sexual assault, but it also includes things like homicide, drunk driving, burglary, all kinds of different things, hate crimes, etc. I'm pleased to share with you our first ever formal policy agenda. In past years, we've taken positions on issues that have strengthened crime victim rights, and we've also testified in support of legislation, but we've not actually put together a formal legislative agenda. We started about 15 years ago, and so we're excited about growing in this way legislatively. Just wanted to share a little bit about us. We provide education resources and supportive legislation for issues related to crime victims. So we have a membership and we do a lot of training with them and provide resources for them. Our vision is to really put victims' rights at the forefront of the criminal justice system by changing Minnesota's response to crime. Kind of a hearty vision, but we want to be really clear about where we stand on those issues. And in short, we really strive to provide a unified voice to victims of crime. And so just to kind of take you through our policy agenda, we understand that this is, I think, a pretty big legislative agenda, and we certainly don't expect to see all these things happen in 2009, but we just want to be very clear with the public and policymakers about where we stand on things. The first section is highlighted as in terms of victim legislation, and you may know about 611A. It's a statute that relates to crime victim rights, and so we feel it's important to strengthen that and ensure compliance with that. And also, we believe that Minnesota should have a crime victim bill of rights. And then we just kind of have a couple of examples of where definitions aren't as clear as they could be. For instance, reasonable notice. For some counties, that's maybe a week. For other counties, maybe that's a day. So we'd like to see some clarification on that down the road. We also believe it's critical to continue existing funding for crime victim services. We got a small bump a few years ago, and we're hoping to hold on to that this year. We also know that of the counties in Minnesota, not all of them have general crime funding or victim advocacy funding, so we would like to see at some point some expansion there. Carolyn talked a little bit about the statute of limitations for sex crimes, and that's something that we support as well. And in general, I think what MnCASA does, we support as well, because we are supportive of victims of sexual assault as well. So kind of a general common thing there, I think, to just let folks know about. And then just some other things, just talking about statute of limitations issues, enhancements, some child endangerment issues if somebody is choosing to drive drunk while their child is in the car. And like many policy issues, these often come out of anecdotal stories that people share with us. And people come to our policy committee and say, you know, we're concerned because this happened in my county. Can we try to take a stance on this and do something more with that? Victim restitution is a really big issue, as is reparations. We'd like to see maybe some creative enforcement strategies, perhaps wage garnishment or other ways to get people to pay when they owe. We also, at some point, would love to see a way for paying for victim services as to basically assess a fee for people who choose to perpetrate crime based on the severity of their crime. So a misdemeanor level versus felony level, we'd like to say, well, you know, you chose to perpetrate a misdemeanor crime, so you owe X amount that'll go directly to your local crime victim services, et cetera. Because we just kind of feel like that's sort of a clear way of helping to offset some of those costs. And then, of course, avoiding further victimization. This may also fall sort of under the prevention spectrum. We believe in for instance, if emergency funds, so let's say I'm hit by a drunk driver and my car is impounded. In some cases, I need to pay those fees out of pocket. So we'd like to see situations where there's pots of money to help me avoid further victimization by having to not only get hit by a drunk driver, but then have to pay my own impound fees. We also want to touch a little bit about primary prevention. Of course, that's preventing crime before it happens. We don't have any ideas for that, but we just think it's important for us to have that dialogue and be looking at research-based strategies. And then, of course, holding people accountable. And then offenders, we want sex offenders who choose not to participate in treatment programs to serve their full sentences. And then in sentencing, again, I want to mention a little bit. We know that our prison systems are burdened, and prison is really expensive. But we also know that there's ways that we can look at sentencing that goes beyond prison, perhaps more house arrest, perhaps sentencing circles, which is something I wasn't aware of until yesterday, which is a restorative justice approach to working with offenders in the community. And then we get more stories, I think, about this than anything else, and that is criminal vehicular offenses that result in death or serious bodily harm. When people are harmed because of inattentive driving, and typically sentencing guidelines are very, very minimal, and so those families are just mad and frustrated, and victim advocates express concern about that. So that's, in short, our legislative agenda. I welcome your questions, and also just want to let you know that we are having a Day on the Hill event on January 29th. Marty Seifert happens to be the brother-in-law of our board president, and so he has agreed to host it. And we welcome you all to come and visit with us and our member programs to learn about them. I know that each of your communities probably has a member program, and they'd love to talk to you further. And certainly, we are also available if you ever need anybody to help testify in support or against something as well.
Thank you, Ms. Sweet. Are there any questions among the committee members?
No. Mr. Chair, I do have a committee, okay, or a question. Yes, I was wondering, under your some of the things you'd like the committee to take a look at when you talk about expanding the definition of reasonable notice. Certainly reasonable is a fairly nebulous standard. Do you have any specific suggestions on what you'd like to see as a measure
actually,
of reasonable?
Reasonable notice. I'm not even going to touch reasonable though. reasonable notice, we don't actually, but we would just like it to be clearer. And certainly if this was something that a committee was going to pick up as an issue, we would want to sit down with them and take the wisdom of our advocates to say, you know, reasonable notice is really a week, because it's really left for each county to define at this point. And usually it's sort of when they can get to it because they're so busy.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sweet. Are there any other questions among the committee members? Okay. Chair Lesh had to step out of the room, but he said he does have a question for you, so would you please stand by till he returns. All right. Thank you for waiting, Ms. Sweet. Chair Lesh has returned to the chamber, so...
Okay.
We will proceed with the hearing.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Ms. Sweet, I had a question regarding enhancement on your sheet for enhancement for child endangerment.
Yes.
When a driver is arrested for a DUI involving a child pastor. Are you talking about, well, can you explain that?
Let's say I go to the bar
uh-huh.
and tie one on and bring my 15-month-old son with me,
mm-hmm.
and then I put him in a car seat and decide to drive around the neighborhood drunk.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the situation where I am choosing to put a child passenger in my car with me as I drive drunk.
Okay. My question is, that's already enhanced to a gross misdemeanor
right.
as it stands under the DWI law.
Mm-hmm.
So what change are you proposing?
This came to us from some member programs, and I believe they're wanting to enhance that further to a possible felony.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to remember Mothers Against Drunk Driving is one of our member programs, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and I was just curious about it because I was wondering about it. The child endangerment, of course, is a separate
mm-hmm.
Separate charge, and then the DWI is a separate charge, too, so I just wanted further clarification.
Sure.
I did have another question here, but, you know, I think I lost in the interim, so I'll send it to you separately.
Sure. My contact information is on the sheet, so feel free to let me know.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for coming in and testifying. Next on the agenda for discussion, we have Dave Johnson, Executive Director of CRIMNET CJIS. Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Johnson. Could you please state your name and title for the record before you testify?
Certainly. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Justice Information Services, and I might take a minute in this presentation to explain to you how that differs a little bit from CRIMNET.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I had on here slash. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Approximately 1 year ago, I came to the state of Minnesota after retiring from 32 years in law enforcement and came as the CRIMNET Executive Director. One of the assignments that I received upon arrival was to look at the opportunity of melding the Criminal Justice Information Systems Division of the BCA with the CRIMNET Program Office, with the idea that by combining the two organizations and understanding their various responsibilities, that we could promote in an operation that was more effective within the statutory responsibilities and within the framework of the resources that were available. To that end, we worked for a number of months on an internal basis, doing it as a project with staff, and developed a transition plan to meld the two organizations into one, again, keeping all of the responsibilities intact. That was completed on April 25th. It was then vetted to groups of interest and eventually brought to the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group on June 24th of 2008, in which the policy group passed a resolution of support to bring those two entities together. with the understanding that the responsibilities, again, were to be, remain intact. That was completed after the development of an integration plan and an implementation plan, as it were, that occurred over the period of the next couple of months. And on October 1st, 2008, those two organizations joined, and now we have Minnesota Justice Information Services, of which I am the executive director. Again, though, my position is created by Minnesota Statute 299C65, and I am serve an unclassified service and report to the policy group pursuant to that statute. So we've now been operating as MNJIS for a number of months. It's been an interesting voyage, and things are going very well for us, and we really are starting to see some of the benefits of bringing those two operations with a greater degree of focus, accountability, and understanding of those areas that we have responsibility over and those areas in which we are doing projects and products to the criminal justice information community. To that end, remind the committee that Representative Hillstrom is a member representing the House of Representatives on the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force, and is a member of that group, and again participates in those meetings and the decisions and the responsibilities that are derived from that section of the statute. The focus of today's presentation, I have a handout that hopefully all of you have, was to get a little bit of an understanding of some of the criminal records that are maintained by DCA MNJIS. And so I brought with me a list and with sort of a high-level, hopefully an easy-to-understand description of what some of those systems are. And these systems are provided to the criminal justice community and criminal justice professionals within the confines of the state of Minnesota, and in some cases pursuant to law outside of the state of Minnesota, with the goal that they not only meet the statutory requirements of having those systems and the information that's kept, but enhancing the ability through integration efforts for those criminal justice professionals to do their duties and meet their responsibilities to the highest degree possible. The first system I'd like to talk about is the Computerized Criminal History System, CCH, and it's probably one that this committee is very familiar with. The criminal history system contains information on individuals regarding booking events, court dispositions, and incarceration and or prison data. Criminal histories are maintained on adults and juveniles, and criminal history information is shared with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Interstate Identification Index, commonly known as III, and other criminal justice agencies as authorized or provided by state statute. The criminal history system that we operate is also the entity that receives and processes orders that are issued regarding the expungement or sealing of specific records regarding an individual, criminal history records. Additionally, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in the MNJIS section operates a public criminal history website, and that criminal history website generally contains those conviction, not arrest, but conviction events which occur in the state of Minnesota and are maintained for a period of time of 15 years past the discharge of the sentence. So once all of the implications of the court sentence have been completed, whether that's probation, whether that's time served, whatever those might be, that record will exist in the public criminal history website for a period of 15 years. And Mr. Chair, I could stop at any time if you want to entertain questions, or would you like me to move forward through the whole?
Why don't you go ahead and move forward unless there are questions from the committee members, and there will be some questions afterwards.
The second system that we operate in regard to criminal records is the Predatory Offender Registry System, most commonly known as POR. Those individuals are required to register in the Predatory Offender Registry System are defined by Minnesota statute. That database, again, is maintained and delivered by the MNJIS section of the BCA, is accessible to law enforcement, corrections, prison case managers, and jail staff. It is not a informational site that is accessible to the public. The next system we maintain is the law enforcement message switch, commonly known as LEMS, in which hot files are maintained. And the best way to understand hot files are those files that generally are associated with the name and date of birth, a particular vehicle, a particular driver, a particular individual that has a warning that some sort of action or some sort of special consideration needs to be given to that data entry. Example of that would be warrants. When that is a hot file, when law enforcement runs a warrant check or other qualified users by a name and date of birth, they will receive information back that a warrant exists within the confines of the state of Minnesota, and sometimes on a national basis if it's been filed with the National Crime Information Center, will indicate the nature of that warrant and which county in the state of Minnesota or what jurisdiction is holding that warrant and the various requirements to satisfy the warrants. As a general rule, it means that the individual is going to be arrested. Second example is the Minnesota Gang Database. Again, pursuant to statute, that statewide database is operated by the Department of Public Safety. It has certain statutory limitations and requirements. And again, it's only accessible to law enforcement through the law enforcement message switch system. COPS alerts, those are automated attempts to locate used by law enforcement. It may be in regard to a vehicle, it may be in regard to a person, or maybe in regard to an event in which allows law enforcement on an immediate basis to highlight criminal events, persons of interest, and to be able to transmit that data upon inquiry throughout the entire state of Minnesota. It does have a limit of 72 hours in which that information can be contained in that particular file. Again, there is no public access to any of this information via the LEMS system or the hot file system in the state of Minnesota. The next system is the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos. Again, that is accessible to authorized criminal justice agencies. It is not accessible to the public, and that is a system that now is used in almost all counties. We are not at 100% yet in the state of Minnesota, in which individuals who are brought into booking areas have their photographs taken along with certain biographical information, and that goes into the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos and then is accessible to law enforcement for law enforcement needs. It's used widely for identification and used widely for the creation of lineups that are used to identify possible suspects in criminal events and to further the charging process. And finally, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, APFIS. As a general rule, fingerprints are required from all individuals who are arrested in the state of Minnesota. That was expanded as a result of legislative action during the last session, which went into effect on July 1st of 2008, Minnesota Statute 299C10, which required the taking and submission of a fingerprint to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension on all individuals that are brought into a booking facility, and before a judge can take a plea on a particular case, they have to, within the court, confirm that individual's fingerprint has been taken and has been submitted. A required biometric identification component is necessary for any record to be included on an individual's computerized criminal history. And that is important for all members to understand that in order for a record to appear on a CCH, that there has to be a disposition of some sort from the court system, and there has to be a corresponding biometric identification through a fingerprint of that individual. In the absence of those two components, there are also some other issues that have to come into play, but those are two of the basic required components for that event to appear on a criminal history. If either of those two events do not occur, that disposition will fall into the suspense file, and I will go over that just in one moment. Generally, these fingerprints are submitted electronically now from live scan units provided by the state of Minnesota. We have almost 200-plus live scan units throughout the entire state of Minnesota. With the advent of the G3 live scan and the new APHIS system, which have both been initiatives through CRIMNET and the former CJIS, We now are getting hits and identifications back in less than 5 minutes. Members might recall that in the olden days, when this was a manual system, it would take weeks, if not months, in order to get a return on a fingerprint card to truly identify an individual. We now get that back in a matter of 5 minutes, and our goal is to get that down into a matter of less than 3 minutes. That helps us to ensure that individuals who are brought in and booked, that we can do the best job possible to confirm their identity and then to use that confirmation information to search other databases to ensure that the individuals we have are not wanted on another charge. And that used to be a fairly regular occurrence, in which you would have found out that you had someone who was quote-unquote on the 10 most wanted list, and you didn't even know that that individual was, because it took so long to get that information back. So we have made great progress over the last years with the resources provided in closing that gap and getting a much faster and more efficient system. And just anecdotally also let the members know that we also input into this system latent prints that are taken from crime scenes. And with the combination of the technology improvement and with the statutes that has increased the number of fingerprints because of the mandatory taking of fingerprints at booking, we are starting now to get hits, much like we did with the DNA database, from old criminal issues, from crime scenes in which fingerprints had been removed, latent fingerprints, but either the technology was not good enough to match them or there was not a base print to match to, and now we're starting to solve all sorts of cases in identifying people who are at crime scenes through this new matching capability.
Can I stop you there for a second?
Yes, sir.
Members of the committee may wonder about this. When you talk about biometrics and identifiable biometrics, you're talking a lot about these fingerprints. Now, you go to the movies these days, no one uses fingerprints anymore. It's all the retinal scans. So can you describe why that is the significant identifier that we use? Are we putting all our eggs in that basket? If not, is there option to move to other kinds of biometrics in the future for specific identification of individuals, and what are those biometrics?
Mr. Chair and members, fingerprints are used as the primary biometric identifier because that is the database that has the most significant volume of information. Because fingerprints were the base system of biometric identification going way back when into the archives of the criminal justice system. So that has the highest volume. It has a high degree of reliability, and technology has really made it much more efficient and effective. There certainly are other biometric identifiers, including DNA. And DNA is the one that we hear a lot about now. And the improvements in the DNA system and the improvements in the process making the tests come back faster. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Lab provides DNA testing services for all of law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. And the ability to use DNA has certainly been expanded to a great deal. Additionally, a photograph is considered to be a biometric identifier, as is a retinal scan. Insofar as what the future holds for improvement in the process, I know that we are focusing on a great deal on the combination of DNA and fingerprint technology. And after that, Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert in biometrics, but certainly if the committee would like a further explanation of the potential of biometrics, I'd be more than happy to facilitate someone from our office to come in and move that discussion further.
There may be a time for that, Mr. Johnson. Mostly I just wanted to ask you, because initially it does get confusing for people about how we identify and who we identify, and those who aren't used to the criminal justice system wonder, when you start to get into the nitty-gritty details of who is who, how we've developed using that. So thank you for that explanation, and please continue.
Mr. Chair, are the inherent systems that we are operating. We certainly have many, many more responsibilities. Again, pursuant to the Minnesota Statute 299C65, we still maintain all of the responsibilities of information integration, our connecting points with the criminal justice partners, facilitating discussions on how the sharing of that information can be promoted to make everybody more efficient and to be more effective. We also develop standards for exchange models and try to remain as current as we can in what's happening from a national perspective what's happening in Minnesota, and quite frankly, what's happening with some of our creative partners at the local law enforcement side of the house. Additionally, we are operating those traditional systems that were part of the criminal justice information system, which are somewhere in the neighborhood of 54 other types of products and projects that are ongoing, that are occurring down at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. In regard to criminal history records, this committee may be aware of the problem that we have had in the past with records falling into the suspense file. To that end, and for the benefit of new members, again, when an event happens in the criminal justice system and you do not have a corresponding fingerprint card or a disposition from court, those are the requirements in order to post that event to the criminal history. But along the way, there are a number of other fields of data and information which needs to be matched up in order to have that event get into the criminal history. Whenever there is mismatched information, those links cannot be made, and that event falls into the so-called suspense file. That suspense file is accessible to authorized criminal justice practitioners and to law enforcement. But again, and unfortunately, that creates a gap at times of understanding an individual's complete and total criminal history. For that reason, we have made at MNJIS and at the direction of the legislature a significant effort to close the gap and to reach a point in which no more than 10% of our incoming records fall into the suspense file.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, Representative Szymanski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, you mentioned the APHIS units. You have about 200 deployed across the state. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have approximately 200 live scans, 200-plus G3, G1, G2 live scans. Those feed into the APHIS complex. The APHIS complex itself sits down at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And by the way, we share the APHIS complex with North Dakota and with South Dakota. They get their APHIS services from us to provide some inherent efficiencies and cost sharing.
Okay. And these live scans, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, these live scan units then, are they in fixed locations in you know, sheriff's offices and police departments, or are they in mobile units?
Mr. Johnson.
At the present, Mr. Chair and Representative, at the present time, the preponderance of those are in sheriff's departments or large municipal police departments that provide their own booking system. They're within the confines of the Minnesota State Prisons. They're also located at many of the court sites to deal with those individuals who have, for whatever reason, gotten to the point where they are reaching the termination or taking the plea of their case. They've not had a fingerprint, and so they can get that fingerprint taken there. There is one additional component that we were working on, and currently the further rollout of that system is on hold pending further resource availability, and that is the rapid two-finger ID. And that may be representative of what you're thinking about, in that we had a number and continue to maintain a system in which these rapid two-finger IDs could be used in a mobile environment in police agencies, and in fact, many police agencies, the state of Minnesota provided them with that service within the confines of jails and then sometimes at courts, in which an individual, it looks like a wand on a stick, and we certainly could do a demonstration for the committee. You take your two fingers and roll them. It transmits those two fingers to the APHIS complex and comes back almost instantly with an identification. They had great success in the field, especially with law enforcement, in preventing individuals from falsely identifying themselves, and was also used to ensure that as individuals moved in and out of jail facilities and so forth, that their identity was truly confirmed to make sure that the right people were moving.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And I think a demonstration of that would be worthwhile for this committee. I know I certainly would like to know the goods on each one member of this committee, so if we can get that all together, that'd be great. Anyway, please continue.
Representative, Mr. Chair, just one thing. They first would have to have their fingerprints in the APHIS system. So,
well, some of them do, I assure you.
Okay. after hearing that, the suspense file, again, we have been working on that. We have now got it down to approximately 11.5 10%. And we are almost at that goal of keeping at 10% or less. Again, the advent and passage of the 299C10 statute helped a great deal in making sure that fingerprint cards were submitted, which was one of the large sources. Additionally, we are working with locals through a suspense reduction process in which we send teams from our office out to counties and areas that have an unusually high suspense submission rate, and we work on business practices with them to close that rate down. And additionally, we're working on some technical changes to ensure that the information provided by the MINSA system, that's the court information system that was recently deployed in all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota, that system can accurately and appropriately feed the fields of data into our criminal history. Once all of those have been accomplished, we are confident that the suspense files will come within the range that we were all looking for.
And Mr. Johnson, what you may have said this already, but what is that range compared to what it is now? What's the range you want it at?
No, Mr. Chair and members, that range would be no less than 10% of the records falling into the suspense category.
Okay, and again, what is it at right now?
As of this morning, it was 11.29%.
Okay, thank you.
And that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair, and certainly could stand for any questions from yourself or members.
Are there questions from the committee members? One question I have, just to give committee members a little bit better idea of this, Mr. Johnson, is can you give us an example of, say, an individual who was stopped on 94 between here and St. Cloud in 1981 and has, say, not that we had this back then, but let's say a registered sex offender in Ohio has a felony theft warrant out of Florida and maybe is currently on probation for a violation in Coochin County versus what would happen then in 1981, what would happen today with our current system. Now that of course presumes that we would have any information, that the local officer or trooper would have any information through what we have right now regarding other counties or other states. What's the difference between those two times? And my question is generally, how have we developed into the system we have now versus what it used to be?
Mr. Chair and members, it doesn't take me much to understand what was in 1981 because I started law enforcement in 1976. And when those types of stops were made at that particular time, there was no integrated information system. There was no availability from a law enforcement perspective for that individual trooper, sheriff's deputy, or police officer to make queries and get a rapid response back on that individual to get a more comprehensive look of what their various aspects might have been. We were left with a system in which you would get on a radio and call to your dispatcher, who would then plug it into a computer system and send messages to different locations and would hope, whether it was we did not have a unified warrant system in the state of Minnesota, which certainly was the NCI federal system, but all required manual backup checks. And so if you made that type of a stop and those types of inquiries, the responses you got back would be very, very slow. And officers in the field were always at a point where they had to make a decision whether or not what they had stopped that individual for was worthy of holding them for the length of time that it took to get the informational check back. In some cases, we were talking about not a matter of minutes, we were talking about half an hour situations, and I can remember with great clarity times in which I would get a message back from a dispatcher on an individual I had released an hour before, where I found out that they had some sort of a hit from out of the state of Minnesota or in northern Minnesota or whatever, and that person that I'd long since had to allow them to leave. Now, most of those systems, through the process of what we've accomplished through the CRIMNET process, the CGIS, what they have done over the years, and the technology that's been driven out into the field, those types of checks are made very, very quickly. Responses are received very, very quickly. Officers in the field now, through the integration of information, have the ability to get a massive amount of information on what they are working on in a very short period of time. which not only promotes public safety, but quite frankly, having sat in that chair in the dark in the middle of the night, it has made it much safer for police officers to operate in this state, that the integration of that information. And it can't even be compared. I know when computers came into squad cars, all of us old timers, you know, sort of wondered, you know, this is an intrusion. And now, having left being a police manager, it's hard to get a trooper, a sheriff's deputy, or a local officer to take a car that doesn't, you know, if the computer is down, they want to grab a car that has the computer. Because it's gotten so good, and the impacts are just so beneficial that, all of the law enforcement officers operating in Minnesota and the administrators recognize the value.
Mr. Johnson, what agency were you with in 1976?
Brooklyn Park.
Okay. I was a Brooklyn Park kid in 1976. I don't think you ever caught me for anything. And if you did,
Mr. Chair, if I did, I certainly wouldn't reveal it here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Very prudent. I want to further ask you, in this situation that I described, if this individual who was a registered sex offender in Ohio, felony theft warrant out of Florida, and on probation for something in Coochin County, is stopped on Interstate 94 up there, and they have, say, a Mankato address, what are you going on their driver's license, or that's the only information you have? How many checks are you going to make to find out what exactly you should do, what you should check for, and where you should check for it? When you're on the horn or on the radio doing that?
Mr. Chair, members, that's a great question, and part of that question goes back to what was the initial reason that I stopped the individual, and what ability do I have to move on with business, and what availability do I have to hold that individual? Certainly, I have more time to make a more detailed check and work through my dispatcher or send messages back and forth from my mobile environment if, in fact, I've got a reason I'm going to effect an arrest, I've got a bona fide reason to hold that individual. To the extent that I may be working on an event in which that individual cannot be arrested, a petty misdemeanor offense such as a traffic ticket, a speeding ticket, to the extent that I can get those checks done within a reasonable time, they will be made and clarification sought. But there still are some times in which that still cannot be accomplished. To that end, though, because of the electronic information we received back in the audit trails, it does give us a starting point if we find something out to be able to accomplish what we may need to accomplish. In other words, if that we find out that that individual had a arrest for their warrant and they had a Mankato address and we were stopping them on the way to St. Cloud, we could send a message up further along the 94 corridor. We could call back to the home jurisdiction, and there's a number of very efficient ways of alerting law enforcement that we just had this contact, we confirmed, and this individual has a bona fide reason to be arrested. Or we can pass on information as need be to a registry or any other type of location that's looking for information.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson. And now, in 2008, if you made that same stop, if a person has, under the current system that we have, that you describe, that we're trying to move into, if a person had the felony theft warrant out of Florida, or it was a registered sex offender in Ohio, would that also be revealed in your checks off the computer that you have?
Mr. Chair and members, certainly the fact that an individual is a registered sex offender in Minnesota will appear. I can't tell you for sure. I can find out for the committee whether or not an individual, if they're a registered sex offender in Ohio, I just don't know whether that information is transmitted through the national files. I can certainly find out whether it is or not. In regard to that other information, yes, we can find that out.
And is that revealed instantaneously, Mr. Johnson, or is it something you have to do an additional check on, make additional calls on at the time, pending what your PC to hold them on the spot?
Mr. Chair and members, the information in regard to a warrant would come back instantaneously. The process always has been and still remains that once an indicator is given to law enforcement that a warrant exists, that the entity holding the warrant has to be contacted and the warrant has to be confirmed. And by legal definition within the framework of the system, that confirmation has to come back in 10 minutes or less. In order to enter any type of a warrant, whether it's in the state system or in the national system, an entity has to ensure that staffing is available to receive an inquiry, pull the warrant, confirm that it exists, and respond back within no longer than 10 minutes. So clearly that is much more efficient than what it used to be.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Johnson from committee members? If not, Mr. Johnson, thank you very much. I'm certain this committee will want to know more about the developments in this context. Members should also know that, obviously, in our movement towards this unified record system depends highly upon funding, and much of this will go through Representative Paymar's committee. However, there are certain aspects of what we're doing here that this committee may want to weigh in on, especially vis-a-vis the other topics we'll be talking about as they impact collateral sanctions, because the information is so much more available out there. But thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. I would also be speaking with other individual members of you, as I have some, about what kind of topics we're going to be bringing up. Before we do, though, I wanted to introduce Tricia, our able page for the committee. Give a wave, Tricia. Oh, what are you?
I'm filling in for
Car. Ah, okay. Well, you know, there you have it. Who is our real page then, Tricia?
Megan Swanberg.
Excellent. Megan Swanberg. Okay, thank you. There's no other business on the agenda right now. I will state it's the intention right now, in conjunction with Chair Hillstrom, for me to bring bills into this committee, and we will be meeting, I'm imagining right now, 2 out of every 3 weeks on average, but that depends on which bills we get and also what other business we have before us. So without anything else, the committee is adjourned.